Well, welcome everybody. Thank you all for coming. I really appreciate it on such short notice. For any of you expecting to hear a discussion on patent issues today, I assure you that the panelists would probably be willing to wing it. But unfortunately, this event today is on the internet and how local and state entities look at the internet and the upcoming convergence issues. We did have a patent hearing scheduled for today, or patent event scheduled for today, but unfortunately, the House Judiciary Committee scheduled the same subject at this particular time and took all of our panelists. So we had this in the can, and we decided to pull the trigger on it. So thank you all for coming. It's really appreciated. I'm Tim Lorden with the Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, and we try to put together fair and balanced discussions on these issues. And we thought we put together a four-person panel, which is our standard operating procedure, to look at this important issue. For our moderator today, we've enlisted a board member of the Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, one of the founding board members of this organization, which is committed to non-advocacy, not supporting any particular legislative prescription. His name is Roger Cuscetti, and he's going to be a moderator today, and I just want to briefly introduce him. He's group director for U.S. public policy for CompTIA. Before that, he worked at VeriSign. You've probably heard of that company. And before that, at IBM, where he joined the Internet Education Foundation's board, my board. He has been around these issues for many, many years. Before that, he was at ComSat. He has basically been at the forefront since there was an Internet. So I'd like to introduce Roger Cuscetti, our moderator.
Thank you, Tim. I'm pleased to be here, and I was delighted to have an opportunity to participate in this panel, in part because for those who have followed the evolution of the Internet since even before it was called the Internet to the time it was the NSFNet or the DARPANET, the issue of the role of states and cities has been an important issue. This is nothing new, and it's only recently come to the fore, and as Tim, I think, implied, as technologies converge, it's becoming a compelling issue that we're all going to have to deal with. But it's not widely known that before there was an Internet, back when there was a DARPANET, the state governments were actually quite involved in the formation of this DARPANET through the state university system. And when there was an NSFNet, before there was an Internet, many state governments were active participants in the NSFNet for communications and other activities. As the Internet has grown and as it has now emerged as a force and a factor in all of our lives, in every sector of the society, in every sector of every level of government, and in every aspect of our economy, it's not surprising that city and state governments who have had historic responsibilities to provide education, law enforcement, health, public health, and other services for their citizens are becoming more deeply involved in the Internet. First and foremost, we all know that most municipal and state governments today rely on the Internet for their own operations. Some state and municipal governments have gone all the way and are completely Internet-centric, but every one of them, and there's not a single state agency, I think, in the country today that is not an active user in the Internet and doesn't rely on the Internet to provide many of the services that it does to its citizens. But the subject of today's discussion goes a little bit further than that, and that is the role of the state and cities, the states and the cities, in regulating the Internet. This touches on the constitutional responsibilities of the federal and state governments to exercise responsibility or authority over different types of activities. We all know that the issue in this case is far more complicated than discussions that took place almost 100 years ago regarding jurisdiction over the telecommunications networks, or, for that matter, discussions that took place 60 or 70 years ago on authority over broadcasting networks, or even more recently, jurisdiction over cable television networks, because the Internet, at the end of the day, is actually a network of networks, and it's not a network that one party builds and owns and operates, but rather it's an interconnected network of networks that's comprised of, at this point, almost 1 million networks, each of which have voluntarily decided to interconnect with the other 999,999 from every country, every province, every city, essentially, in the world. we've got four, I think, very distinguished people to give us their perspective on this issue, and in particular focus on some of the emerging issues, which we're all going to be following in the newspapers and in the press as they become more visible. Our first is Commissioner Deborah Tate. Debbie is the former assistant legal counsel to Governor Lamar Alexander, now Senator Lamar Alexander, and a former assistant to Representative Don Sundquist. So she has a wealth of experience at the federal level in the Congress and the issues that come up in the Congress. She is the just departed chair of the Tennessee Regulatory Commission, and she now heads up the NARUC effort in this area and will be sharing with us, I think, the perspective of state regulators. Rick Zimmerman is with the National Cable and Telecommunications Association. He's had 5 years experience. Recently, he was also with state public utilities commissions. He was for 5 years in the staff of the Maryland and Florida state PUCs, and he's going to share with us the perspective of the NCTA and its members. Cheryl Lianza is with the National League of Cities. She recently joined the National League of Cities. Before that, she'd spent 6.5 years with the Media Access Project, a well-known public interest law firm, and she's widely recognized and often quoted in the press for her comments on telecommunications regulatory issues. And last but by no means least, Ed Merlis with the U.S. Telecom Association has been with the USTA for about 2 years. He had spent 13 years with the Air Transport Association, but I think more to the point, used to work in the cable industry himself, and he will share with us the perspective of the UST members. We're going to the way the program will proceed is that we're going to ask each of the panelists, going down from left to right down the table, to offer us some introductory comments of 3 to 5 minutes. I'm going to ask you to hold your questions until all the panelists have finished their opening remarks. The panelists who go over the time limit are going to start to hear the tap on the which is a reminder, but I'm sure we'll keep to our time limit. After that, we'll have a brief discussion among the panelists and give them an opportunity to ask each other questions. And then we'll open it up to questions from the floor. When you ask a question from the floor, there's a couple of important things about that. First, it is important that you identify yourself, and please excuse me for cutting you off if you forget that you're supposed to identify yourself, because we need to know who you are. Secondly, statements are welcome as long as they're brief and followed by a question. And thirdly, it is important that your question be reasonably concise, because I'm going to have to repeat your question for the purposes of the recording of this event. And if you ask a very long, complicated question, we can all be sure that I'm going to get it wrong, and then we're going to waste a lot of time going back and forth between you and me on what your question was or wasn't, and waste time for the panelists. So, again, when question time comes, please identify yourself. If you're going to make a statement, make it brief, and make your question simple enough so that it can be repeated, and I think understood by everyone. Without any further delay, let me ask Debbie if she would begin her opening remarks. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And actually, I wanted to just clarify one thing. And since we're just meeting those who are introducing us, I didn't have the opportunity to work with Congressman Sundquist when he was here, but actually when he became the governor of the state. So I don't have nearly as much knowledge about what you all do every day here. My introduction seemed to state. But I'm very honored to be here. I hope you all never lose the ability to look around a room like this and realize the history that you all are helping to make every day that you spend in this place. It's great to be able to be back here and to talk about issues that are facing us in Nashville, Tennessee, as well as you all in Washington and all around the country. I'm actually pinch hitting for our president, Diane Munns, who was here yesterday. Many of you all were at the subcommittee hearing on IP. And actually, I was going to take a little, I just wanted to refute the name of this panel, regulation of the internet or something, and say, okay, well, my only statement is we don't. So I'll just move on. But, you know, a little more seriously, I guess one of the things that I wanted to do is to talk about the fact that this is, you know, much greater discussion than just about the telecommunications industry. That we had a little seminar back several months ago, and one of the things I said was when you all helped to rewrite the Telecom Act, why don't we call it something that nobody could be against, like let's make it the Jobs and Investment in America Act, you know, because isn't that what we're all really talking about, is jobs and reigniting an economic engine for our country. Yesterday, the statistic, and you all have all read it, we've dropped to 16th in the world in broadband deployment now. You know, that's hard to believe for America. Every time I read it. In fact, I have to redo my speeches every few weeks because we drop another notch. You know, I call a staff person and say, where are we now? But I guess one of the things that I wanted to say was just to offer to all of you all in the room who are staff to our congressional staff that we want to be, each of us, every single commissioner across the country wants to be an honest broker of information for you all. If we can assist you all in finding out stats in your particular state, in your particular congressional district, that's what we would like to do, because what we're really all trying to do is work together. This isn't for or against, yes or no. This is that we've got to have some new policies for the future of this country. So with keeping that in mind, I guess I just wanted to make that offer to you, and then also just a few kind of broad remarks. One is I think that we need, as we are moving forward, to really talk about a statutory construct that is based on principles and that is not tied to language, the whole concept of old words, old wires, old regulations. We still keep talking about the word telecommunications. We don't even know what the next platform or innovation or technology is going to be. So let's stop limiting and make more flexible how we are going to regulate whatever there is in the future. So I guess that's just watch the words and language that you all choose as you're drafting wisely. Build in flexibility that can survive longer than a few months or a few years. It's also interesting that there are very appropriate roles for the states as we move forward. You know, a lot of you all know, many of your states probably, Tennessee passed a Telecom Act before Congress passed one. We passed Do Not Call legislation years ago. In fact, we decided not even to turn over our Do Not Call list because when we asked the FCC and FTC, they were very confused about who would do what and who would respond to consumers. And basically, when we were told if we get a complaint, the citizen will fill out something on the internet. And we said, what if they don't have access to the internet? And, you know, we respond to those complaints every single day. In fact, to the tune of over 2,000 each year, which brings me to another point, and that is, do you want to build up a complaining place, Consumer Affairs Division at the FCC, to take the 2,000 times 50 state complaints? And that's just at a bare minimum. And for a very small state like Tennessee, I'm sure it's much, much larger. So I think there are some things that we do well, and consumer education, protection, and outreach is one of them. It's also interesting because I think that, you know, we all have state authority that is goes back to the original state police powers over the health, safety, and welfare of our citizens. And so just because a company is someplace else in the country, you know, and they injure a citizen in Tennessee, that doesn't keep, you know, the insurance, banking, whatever, from, you know, getting involved in many cases. You know, we've been involved in many of those. Just to give you, I'll give you a real specific example of our Do Not Fax law that went into effect, I think it's been almost 2 years ago. We have Shop at Home Network. You all may have seen it on the internet, and a fax blaster, I don't know, you know, these companies that are all over, in fact, lots of them are located beyond our borders, but started faxing, and because this company is so reliant on numerous telephone lines, the fax started rolling to the next and the next and the next, and so it basically shut down the entire company. Well, if their alternative had been to call and complain at the FCC, I guess we'd still be seeking an NPRM right now to figure out what to do with that. And I'm not being critical. I'm just saying that, you know, that day we jumped in and got involved and, you know, got the company to resolve the problem. It worked out well. The company also paid a big fine. So in some cases, I think we do our jobs well. But, you know, we do need to think about incenting investment. I mean, I am concerned not just about the economic engine of our country, but the economic engine of Tennessee and more jobs coming to Tennessee and more new businesses. So certainly whatever we do, we want to do so that we're not stifling that new investment, but that we're encouraging it. So whatever scheme is going forward, you know, certainly, I think we would all hope that we're not reimbursing people at less than what their cost is for investments that they make in our state and in our country. I guess my final statement, because I know we need to move on, is just to keep in perspective all the IP considerations that we're talking about. It's exciting. The president has set this broadband deployment goal of all Americans having access. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but to broadband by 2007, and that would be wonderful. Tennessee was actually, we're almost in every survey, 48th, 49th, or 50th, we always say thank heavens for Arkansas and Mississippi. But, you know, that's where we usually are. Incredibly, in hooking up our schools and libraries, we were number one in the whole country. I'm so proud of that. It was under my former governor, and while there have been problems with the E-rate system, they're process problems. They're problems that can be fixed. You know, they're auditing problems. This isn't let's throw the baby out with the bathwater. So I just had to tell you all about Tennessee being number one in something. And so in keeping things in perspective, I guess my point is that while, sure, we hope every single American is going to be able to use, you know, IP technology and have all these fabulous new innovations, in some states like Nebraska, almost 50% of the lines are rural LEC lines. These are people that, y'all, have a phone. You know, everybody in this room, hold up your BlackBerry. You know, hold up your laptop. We all are connected in multiple ways, but we just can't lose sight of the people, whether they're in rural Tennessee, in Appalachia, or in North Dakota, that almost half of those people don't have that opportunity yet. So I think we have a long way to go, and while we're thinking about the future, and I'm encouraging you all to think about how you have a flexible set of rules, regulations, and policies, we can't forget that we've still got people that are not at that point yet, so there's got to be a transition for those folks along the way. I'll stop my remarks and answer questions.
Okay. Rick? Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. Let me start off right at the bat here, agreeing with Commissioner Tate that I think the title Regulating the Internet is not necessarily quite apropos, because I don't think that state and locals and even the feds do a whole lot of regulating the Internet per se. But I think the real question is the regulation of IP-enabled services, whether it's voice, video, data, whatever it is. So I'm going to focus my remarks a little bit on that. I want to begin by quoting from our CEO at NCTA, and that's always a good way not to get in trouble. And he was asked in an interview, it's our new CEO recently came on board, Kyle McSlarrow, former number two at the Department of Energy, and he was asked about our view of the 96 Act. And he said, our view is that the argument that the 96 Act was a failure is flawed. There's no American consumer today who would say anything other than we're better off today than we were in 96. Look at the services. Look at the broadband deployment. The American people are smart. They understand because they're living it right now. They have many more services for less money, greater variety, greater choice, greater control. Whether or not all of that is attributable to the 96 Act is probably open to debate, but it's hard to argue that it's a failure. So that's the premise where we begin in looking at the Act. And I know that, you know, particularly for those of you that live here in the sort of cocoon of Washington and have been exposed to some of my friend Ed's $40 million ad campaign about the Act and that it needs to change. But our view is that, you know, a wholesale rewrite is not what is necessary. Now, we recognize that, you know, there may be, in the context of IP voice or IP video, some issues that raise some additional questions and may not be answered clearly by the existing statutory framework. And so it's perfectly appropriate for Congress and the FCC to go through the various proceedings necessary to understand the issues and do what's necessary as a result. But we don't think that translates into wholesale changes in the Act. So let me talk a little bit about the framework that I believe, or the prism perhaps, that all of these things should be viewed through, whether it's voice, video, data, whatever it is. And some of you, this is, I guess, shameless plug time. Some of you may be familiar with our NCTA policy paper issued in February 2004, and this was about VOIP in particular. It was called Balancing Responsibilities and Rights, a Regulatory Model for the for Facilities-Based VOIP Competition. And the key there is the balancing of responsibilities and rights, or rights and responsibilities, you know, depending on your emphasis. But the point is, what we said in this paper and continue to believe, and this was mainly about voice, but also applies to video, was that there are certain core responsibilities that any service provider ought to meet. And in the context of voice, that meant access to E911. It meant working with law enforcement. It meant providing access for the disabled, participating in universal service, compensating where appropriate other network owners for the use of their network, otherwise known as intercarrier compensation. So there are certain core responsibilities on the voice side. Similarly, there are certain core rights that should come along with that. One is the right to interconnect, the right to get numbers, the right for liability protection in the context of E911. I'm not going to go through the whole list, but that was the basis for what we did here on voice. Similarly, one can look to the video side, and this is where, to some extent, the local regulators come a little bit more into the picture than perhaps on the voice side and ask, because, you know, we have heard quite a bit recently, especially, about video and how IP video ought to be treated in the future. And first of all, our view on IP generally is that it certainly enables providers to go out and get into the business, whatever it is, voice, video, whatever, more quickly. But it's not a magic bullet. Something touches the internet and therefore is inviolate and no possibility of regulation. In fact, what we've seen in terms of IP video seems pretty squarely like what cable is offering. But, you know, we're getting sort of mixed messages, because I know that my friend Tom Talkie from Verizon addressed some of Cheryl's constituents, in this case the mayors, recently, and said it's not logical to treat different sectors of the communications marketplace differently based on what technology they use when they're all delivering the same service. And we would subscribe to that as sort of a core principle, kind of treat like services alike, whether it's voice or video. We have tried to make that point clear. But on the other hand, for those that have been to a couple of the recent hearings on this issue, there seems to be a lot of discussion about the idea that franchising, which, you know, again, Cheryl is going to make her own case here, but you know, that franchising is something important, but some new providers are trying to get out of those various responsibilities. And certainly you can look at the current law, and then you can talk about what ought to happen in the future. But when you're talking about what ought to happen in the future, we've got to go back to our prism about this core responsibilities and core rights. And what are the core responsibilities at the local level? One of them certainly is that local communities ought to have the right to manage their public rights of way, We may disagree on how much we ought to pay for that privilege, but nonetheless, communities ought to have the right to manage their local rights of way. There are important questions about localism, important questions about the carriage of broadcast signals. I mean, we could go through the list, but to simply wave your hand and say that franchising is, you know, is not an important local concern, and that there's a historical reason for why these various requirements exist is really, I think, not the right way to look at either the future or past services. So let me just make one point about state regulators. What we view the important role of state regulators in particular is to oversee carrier-to-carrier activity or carrier-to-carrier disputes. Because we don't believe, certainly the FCC has some expertise, they have some resources, but the idea that with every situation that you've got a problem that you're going to run to the FCC is, I think, just not that credible. And states have resources, they have expertise, they know what they're doing in this regard, so we think one of the important core functions for states would be overseeing carrier-to-carrier interconnection. So like services alike, rights and responsibilities, and state oversight of carrier-to-carrier activity would be our sort of three goals and appropriate framework for viewing these services.
Thanks. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk today. I pass on the regrets of Mayor Fellman, who was testifying before the House yesterday. We would have liked to have our mayors here, but we weren't able to do that with the timing of this panel. I wanted to let you know the League of Cities represents 18,000 cities across the country. We represent local elected officials. These are mayors and city council. The important thing, I'm going to start off with, you know, what are the thoughts, what are the issues that are driving cities, and then talk to you about three requests that we specifically made of Congress and of the House committee yesterday. Talk a little bit more about those. I think it's important to remember that local elected officials embrace new technology. They want new technology. Local governments are huge users of technology. They purchase this technology, so they are rapidly moving to using these internet-based services themselves. They're looking for economical means to use them, so they are looking for this technology. They receive the same pressure as federal elected officials from constituents, small businesses, and big businesses to get this technology out there. So I think wanted to make clear how you know, our members and our mayors are very, very interested in moving this technology ahead to meet both their political pressures and their own needs. Cities, I think like everybody here would agree, want to treat like services alike. Therefore, neutral government regulation, services that are viewed as similar by a consumer should face similar obligations and similar benefits from government entities, including local government entities. One approach that has been discussed, as Rick mentioned, has been an IP-only approach. And that sounds more like not technology neutrality. That sounds like technology offered on the internet, whether it's analogous to traditional voice service, is going to be given one set of treatment, whereas technology that doesn't use the internet would be treated differently. And that is not technology neutral, and I think that's going exactly against all of the things that we have learned from the Telecommunications Act thus far. The final driver is federalism and localism. It's clearly a historic part of our democracy in this country. And importantly, many local elections rely on video communications right now. People need those access to their local elected officials so they can vote in their city council elections, so they can vote for their mayors. They need that information. And so there's one reason, core democratic reason, why I think video programming in particular is very important and very local. And historically, our policies across the board have supported local video regulation. As I mentioned, Mayor Fellman from Arvada, Colorado, testified on behalf of the League of Cities and the technology advisors to elected officials yesterday. I also want to let you know that I have some information out front, not everybody got it, describing what he said yesterday, and obviously I'd be happy to give everyone a copy of his testimony. That'll be on the League of Cities website momentarily. I think some information is already up, and that's www.nlc.org. if anybody's interested. So yesterday, what did we ask Congress? We asked Congress to take a deliberative approach as it considers the appropriate scheme for addressing IP services. We think we need a deliberative approach because I think we all would agree that last year we looked at voice over internet services and we thought, oh, well, this is great. We'll just deregulate all these voice over internet services. There's no need to do anything. This year, we're hearing chilling testimony in front of the House Commerce Committee that there are people in their house with gunmen in the basement, and they can't get to 911. This is clear evidence that we need to think about this. We need to think carefully about these social obligations before we just move ahead, and it's important to go through that process. Second, we ask Congress to recognize local government's inherent police powers over its rights of way. There's two core parts of this. First, the first part of it is local governments making sure that they can take care of safety of the physical space. It's not just telecommunications companies that are in the right-of-way. This is gas, electric. You have real potential for danger, and local governments have very clear rules and guidelines and standards that they follow to make sure that we don't get exploding manholes, gas leaks, floods. And that's critically important. And I don't think Congress or the FCC or anybody else is going to come and take care of everybody's sidewalks on 5th and Main. It's just not going to happen. The second part of that is these are public assets. Local elected officials are acting as fiduciaries on behalf of the public. And in these times of rising budgets, local elected officials need to manage public assets extremely carefully and wisely. And they would be rightly criticized if they did not collect rent for those public spaces. And I think when we talk about generally the obligation to compensate carriers for use of their networks, I don't see there's any reason why the public should be the only one offering things for free. And I note, for example, that the federal government charges for spectrum nowadays. Way back when, we used to give it away for free. Nowadays, we realize that this is a private sector business making a profit, and they have to, engage and incur their basic costs for doing business. The final point that we asked for Congress to take into account is just the neighborhood-by-neighborhood expertise of local elected officials. One of the important roles that local elected officials play, for example, in video regulation, is to ensure ubiquitous deployment. Right now, cable is widely, widely deployed throughout the country, and that is because local elected officials said, wait a minute, what about the neighborhood on the wrong side of the tracks? What about these people who are a little farther away than you might want to deploy your infrastructure? And made sure that over time, not instantly, but over time, that these networks were deployed. That type of knowledge and that type of negotiation and follow-through and oversight cannot happen from Washington. And the reasonable accommodations that might need to be made in terms of the times of deployment and schedules and things like that, that also can't be made in Washington. That's just too time intensive. There are a few other important things. I think we mentioned them briefly, the public access channels, the government channels, the way that citizens, one of the only ways that you ever see a city council person on television ever is on a public access channel. And these are people who are controlling significant portions of our daily lives as citizens. So I think those are some, and there's a lot more we can talk about, but those are some of the core things that I think we have in our social contract with video providers, and we think they're very important. Thank you.
You can pass that.
Sure.
Going last has its benefits and its liabilities. One of the liabilities you've heard a lot, so I'm not going to belabor things. One of the benefits is you've heard what the others have to say, so you can comment on it. So I'll comment on it. First of all, from our perspective, we represent previously wireline telecom carriers who have been around for 100-plus years, ranging in size from our chairman's, which has about 3,000 lines in Annandale, Minnesota, to Verizon, which is one of the 10 largest companies in the United States of America. And these people have decided that there is an opportunity for innovation, an opportunity to grow beyond the bounds that they have been compartmentalized in by virtue of tradition, regulation, legislation, laziness, whatever. It's a new world out there. And as part of that new world, they recognize that it is in their enlightened self-interest to provide to consumers greater choice. Greater choice means that consumers ultimately drive the marketplace, not regulators, not centralized state planning. And that as consumers choose, there's a transparency. Consumers pick a service, they pick a product, they pick something. But They don't really pick, oh, I want wireline telephony or I want wireless telephony. I want to talk to somebody. And I think what we do is we make all this so complex. We become experts in the arcane and fail to recognize that American consumers, and not just American consumers are pretty bright. They can deal with items in the marketplace. They can make intelligent choices. The key is choice. They have to have many choices. And we are moving that way. There is a convergence going on. We've gone from separate long distance and local and mobile and video and internet services to opportunities where a consumer can buy a bundle of services, all distance, voice, by the minute, video packages, things of that sort. We've gone from a system where you had a dial telephone and you had separately a cable box to one where you have BlackBerries and mobile phones with messaging capability, email, video, computer for internet phones, and instant messaging. And so as we move forward, it's not time to rewrite the 96 Act. It's time to update our telecom laws to reflect what technology can bring to bear. And so when the fundamental question is, why do we have to do it? I like to go back to something I saw 18 months ago at our trade show, where one of the chief technology officers of a large company took out his BlackBerry, and he said, I can spend $1 billion and in 1 year bring to market a device like this, which when you're in your office, you put it in a cradle, and it's a wireline phone. If you pick it up and walk around your office, it's Wi-Fi. Without hanging up or anything, you just walk outside the building, and it becomes a wireless device. He says, I can push the stop button. I can push another one and download. He didn't indicate whether it was from satellite or not. He can download CNN, record it on a chip, and play it back later while I'm sitting on the subway going home. I can do this in 1 year for $1 billion, but I'm not going to spend a penny because I don't know how it's going to be regulated. Well, I'm one of those consumers who would like to have that device. More than a year has elapsed, and that device is not there. Parts of it are there, but the device is not there. And the reason is that the regulatory framework in which these technology companies operate is so encumbered by hidebound regulatory structures that have long outlived their usefulness. It's time to update the laws to reflect what technology can bring to the consumer, and ultimately, let the consumer make the choice, consistent, of course, with important social obligations and consumer protections. E911, CALEA, access for persons with disabilities, carrier of last resort obligations. These are important things, so do not make light of them. But the fundamental issue is technology can bring us great choice, and we as consumers are pretty bright. We can figure out what we want and what we don't want. Consumer protection is an important underlying component for all of these services, and it should remain intact, but not down to the level of the micromanagement, which threatens the delivery of these services. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
There we go. Thank you. Thank you very much. Before I begin questions and have a few to start the conversation myself, I should, in the spirit of full disclosure, I do something I didn't in the introduction, and it will help, I think, lead to my first question for the panelists. I should identify a little bit more clearly the trade association for which I work, the Computing Technology Industry Association, CompTIA, is often confused with other groups. We are actually the nation's largest computer industry trade association, but most notable because the bulk of our 20,000 business members are the small, often called value-added resellers, or the small computer companies located in every village, hamlet, and town in the country who equip small business with computer systems. So the next time you go into your dentist's office or doctor's office or real estate agent's office and see the little computer network that they have there, keep in mind that that computer network was not set up by a multinational corporation with three initials, or it wasn't set up by a huge conglomerate. It was set up by a small business that does computer network services, and there are about 30,000 of these little businesses around the country, and and CompTIA is the trade association that most represents that segment. So we as an association have a deep interest in the growth of internet and broadband services. Having given that little bit of background, let me ask the panelists, if I can, to comment on one aspect of the topic that was only tangentially referred to. And it's an important one for all of us, business and consumers alike. For very good reason, most of the discussion of this panel has been on this topic of connectivity, because without connectivity, you don't get content, and if you're not connected to the internet or any other network, all the content in the world is irrelevant to you. But I'd like to invite the panelists, if they have any comments, and Cheryl did offer one comment on content. She explained that local jurisdictions have an interest in the content going over the networks because it's a way to give exposure to local government officials. But I think the real issue is, from the point of view of content providers, do they have a stake in this discussion? How should content providers of any sort view the issue of municipal versus state versus federal versus no regulation at all? I think it's widely believed that there should be some regulation of content. Certainly there is such a thing as illegal content. Everyone would agree with that. But illegal to who and under whose laws? And so I'd like to invite the panelists, if they have a comment on the topic of content. It's the sort of hidden side of the discussion of jurisdiction, because if and when the issue of connectivity is resolved, the issue of content won't be very far behind. So I don't know if anyone would care to comment on that or not.
Through the internet, we have access to a tremendous range of content, and nobody's regulating it. Just today, I downloaded ESPN 360, which is basically a cable service, on my computer. My computer has outputs. It goes right into my television. This morning at 6 o'clock in the morning, I'm watching ESPN from my cable, from the internet. Yesterday, I sat in my office and watched a hearing. It was C-SPAN. So content is essential. People want it. People access it. They hit the www. Whatever it is, and they get it today. I think that's a wonderful thing, and people should be enabled to get it without any intervening government authority other than, obviously, things which violate the law because they're obscene, which is to the extent that that's prohibited by law. Things which are prohibited by law should, of course, remain prohibited by law. But I don't think there should be any intervening government authority who says that I can watch ESPN 360 if I live in Fairfax County, but I can't watch it in Washington, D.C., because some governmental entity says you can't have that.
I'll quickly respond. First of all, I'm not aware of any governmental entity telling people they can't have ESPN. So just to be clear, mayors do not want to deprive you of ESPN. I think the one comment I'll make on content is that most of the government intervention, and the only one on the local level, is to encourage, to make sure that there is additional content that's not otherwise available. Local elected officials are not trying to stop people from getting content that they want. In fact, local elected officials, like government, like federal officials, are probably mostly asked to that by people who are afraid of getting content that they don't want. I mean, that's really the big problem that we have, you know, I think, as representatives of our great constituency. But we do take some action to try and make sure that the organs of local government are open to everyone, to make sure that they can follow and make sure they hold those local elected officials accountable. But that's really, I think, the type of role that I would conceive of.
Yeah, I'll just preface my comments by saying I am not a content expert, unlike Cheryl in her previous job, who is a content expert. But I think one thing we haven't talked about is the sort of finely crafted balance in existing law and presumably future law between content owners and distributors and all of the, you know, the Grokster type issues, the intellectual property issues, which we're not here to discuss. I mean, I think your original question was, should these people be at the table? And, you know, I don't know that the Telecom Act is necessarily a vehicle for what's going to happen in regard to protection for content owners in terms of file sharing or platform distributors. I don't know the answer to that. I would certainly advise them, I guess, to keep track of what's going on. But I did reference something earlier that I'll follow up on, and I do agree with Ed that there should not be a lot of content regulation, or that, you know, if ESPN's making their service available, you should be able to see it anywhere. But there are special rules for broadcasters, and, you know, far be it from me as the cable guy to be shilling here for the broadcasters. After I was shilling for the cities, I'm taking everyone else's role here. But you know, there is some exclusivity rules, for example, distant signal rules, so that, you know, I think to make the broadcaster's argument, it's about local ad revenue and such, so that, you know, if I'm not out in rural Colorado, let's say, that I'm getting my local station instead of the station from Chicago because they want me to see those local Denver ads or whatever it is. So there are those kind of rules that apply on the broadcasters that apply to us and what we carry and to the satellite guys. And one of the questions that certainly SBC's, you know, IP video product raises will be, in terms of the broadcasters, whether those kind of exclusivity restrictions apply, because I imagine the broadcasters will put up a fierce fight if SBC comes in and says they're going to import distant signals without any, you know, paying any fealty to these kinds of rules.
Let me open the floor up to questions then, if I can. As I indicated at the beginning, if you have a question, if you would stand and introduce yourself, they'd be most welcome. Right here, please.
Roy Mark, Internet News. I suppose I have two quick questions. One from his tape. Last year, Tennessee, Senator Alexander, one of the leaders in stopping the notion that all internet connections should be tax-free. And so that really sort of brings the question down, how much of this is an issue about tariffs and taxing as opposed to protecting citizens? And from Ms. Leanza, brought up the issue of 9/11 and the chilling story out of Houston. If a company like Skype, for instance, I read their end user agreement, and they specifically say, we don't provide 9/11 when a Skype call goes out to a traditional phone line. Should states require companies like Skype to say, we're not even offering 9/11 on our service?
Let me repeat the question before you answer it for the record. Roy Mark from Internet News asked Deborah to summarize it, whether this really was all about taxes or how much this was about a debate about taxes and revenue for state or local governments. And he asked a question of Cheryl whether the can the states impose at the state level 9/11 or other similar types of safety services on VOIP service providers.
I'll actually invite, I'm happy to respond to parts of those questions, but I'll invite Commissioner Tate to respond to the state regulation.
Let me also emphasize that whenever a question is asked, every panelist should feel free to comment on it as well. So since the first one was directed to Deborah, let me ask her.
First of all, I think that Senator Alexander is in such a unique, as are many members of Congress who have served as a governor of a state and a CEO, basically, of a state, especially one that is as poor and rural, for the most part, as Tennessee. And if you followed our, you know, budget over the past few years, it has been very dismal. After I left the previous governor's office, there was actually a, quote, tax revolt brought on by DJs all across the state, where hundreds of Tennesseans, most of whom would have never been touched by a tax that was being proposed, were becoming so violent that there were arrests, and actually rocks were thrown through our governor's office window. So it got pretty violent and serious. I'm just trying to lay out how serious the problem is for the state. There are some estimates that there would have been an immediate $80 million loss, and up to $360 million was the last time that I talked to the Commissioner of Revenue. all to say, isn't everything about taxes and subsidies up here? I mean, you know, intercarrier compensation, E-rate, universal service fund. I mean, let's just get down to it. I mean, these are technical, deep, deeply divisive, and very confusing systems. But in the end, it's about who pays who what. And, you know, there's going to have to be an awful lot of discussion. There are, we just inside NARUC, we have a task force of commissioners trying to come to some even just suggestions about intercarrier comp, for instance. And at this point, we don't really have, you know, a specific formula or something that I can, you know, disclose. But anyway, back to your specific question. I mean, I think one of the other just kind of practical things to say is, how could you have anything that was permanent when we don't even know what is going to happen in the next few years? I mean, that's just a practical way to answer your question. And so I think that was one of the points that Senator Alexander was trying to make. I do think that he was also being a very strong supporter of our state and our state budget. However anybody in this room may feel about taxes, it would have been a big hit immediately. Back to the E-911 issue. This is actually something that Tennessee did well, too. I understand that our phase one deployment was one of the first, and our phase two has been. At the same time, we still have a county. I just heard this example the other day where there's no E-911 service from wireless carriers. There seems to be just an issue about trying to make that happen. It should have already happened, and so the E-911 board is working through that. It seems as though part of this issue is going to get taken care of. I believe that it's already been in the trade press that Chairman Martin plans for this to be on the May 16th meeting at the FCC. I would assume that indicates that he will be at least attempting to take some action regarding that. I don't know what that will be, but, you know, I think we're all waiting to see what he is going to suggest about that. Brian, am I correct that it's England that has just set aside an area code? We were just reading an article about England where, interestingly enough, as you all know, this has gone from being called VOIP to just IP, and in England, it's VOB, voice over broadband. So, you know, every time that we come up with a term, you know, of art, it's already changed again. But anyway, so this is the way that England is dealing with this. We don't have the specifics of it. I just saw a blurb. I don't know whether it might be a possibility here or not, given the obvious difference in size of the country. But, you know, obviously other countries are looking at these same issues.
And I'll just respond quickly. I can actually talk briefly about the internet tax moratorium because cities were very, very concerned about that moratorium and work closely with Senator Alexander. Think about it this way. Right now, you want to have your tax policy be neutral. It's a revenue-raising device. We all agree that federal government, local government needs to raise some revenue. Do we want to drive communications policy through tax policy, or do we want tax policy to be as neutral as possible? I think that when you start to carve out certain pieces of any industry and say, well, no, don't tax this, just don't tax that, that actually inhibits the ability of local government to be more equitable and more fair among multiple different competing industries. I think we want to have that to be fair competition among many industries. And I think that, as we all know, so much of commerce, so much of all of our everyday lives are moving to the internet. Are we going to get to the point where we want our property taxes to be so high because our sales taxes can't reach anything that generates revenue or is a building block of the economy? So I think the reason why you keep that moratorium expiring is so we can continue to consider those issues. On the Skype question, I think that's why we're asking for a deliberative process. Obviously, Skype is a service that is basically free and mostly on your computer and not as similar to regular telephone-to-telephone service, so there may be some differences that are appropriate to treat that service. We don't have a position on that specifically, but I would say that's why we need to have a deliberative process, and perhaps it is the case that we need to have clear consumer protection warnings for services services that don't contain those types of processes. I know that that was one of the problems of the family who couldn't reach 911, is that the disclosure hadn't been made to them, and in fact that caused the Texas Attorney General to go after them and to issue a broad warning. And there have been other local governments that have very aggressively warned their citizens to just make sure that they understand. It is absolutely, we encourage them to take these new services if they're meeting their needs for cost and the balance of what they're getting, but let's make sure that they understand they're not getting something that's going to reach the police at this point. And, you know, they need to know that.
I'm sorry.
No, that's we may need to mandate it at many different levels. It may be appropriate for the federal government to mandate some sort of 911 access, and it may be appropriate for states and locals to do that. But I think we are still in that process of evaluating, you know, what are the core goals. I think we've gone, most of the industries have gone, really evolved a lot in their thinking in the last year to 18 months, from realizing, but absolutely upfront recognizing, that 911 is a core service and CLIA is a core service. I don't think that was the case. And I think that as we continue in this conversation, we come up with more agreed upon consensus of where those dividing lines are appropriately drawn and keep them technology neutral.
Well, I'm going to agree with Cheryl that it was not the case for those other providers, but shameless plug again, in our paper available at www.ncta.com, we had the tremendous foresight to answer your question. And what we did was, first of all, to distinguish Skype and Xbox and other services from Vonage, cable-provided VOIP, VoIP services that the Bells might provide, we devised a four-part test. And the three important parts of the test for your question are, does it use North American numbering plan numbers or some successor numbering regime? Does it connect to the public switch network? And does it represent a possible replacement for POTS? Vonage, yes.
And number four, does it quack, quack, quack?
Actually, number four was, does it use IP from the end user to the network, so that you couldn't, as Chairman Powell called it in a slightly different context, sprinkle IP fairy dust on your network and claim that you're, you know, devoid of all regulation. But in any case, Vonage would fit our framework and Skype would not. Maybe someday they will. So I think what's important, first of all, is to have a way. You know, we offered this test. We said this is a good test. Maybe there would be other tests, but the key is that you have some easy-to-apply test that an investor that Ed talked about could look and say, gee, if I offer such and such service, I'm going to fall on this side of the line or I'm going to fall on that side of the line. So that's the sort of first important key, is distinguishing among these various types of services, because Xbox, you know, we all know, has a voice component, but most people, I think, don't believe that, you know, your 9-year-old, when they're slaying the orcs or whatever they're doing, ought to be able to call 911 when they get in trouble. But the other point, in terms of the mandate, we would argue that even though 911, E911 is a core responsibility, as we lay down in the paper, that should probably be a federally handled issue, which is not to say, we've heard a lot of discussion lately about federal framework implemented by states or implemented by local communities, depending on the specific issue that we're talking about. But to the extent there's a mandate at all, I would argue that that ought to be a federal rather than a state-by-state decision.
Please.
Oh, sure.
Again, going last, and just because it's always nice to, I agree, Rick.
Other questions? Right here, the lady. You introduce yourself, please. I'm going to take that as a question to all of the panelists, and let me repeat it for the record. Cheryl Boland with BNA asked the panelists to comment on the allegation she's heard from people in industry that a patchwork of 50 regulations would be terrible and not a good idea, and what do the panelists think of that? So you want to Maybe you
want to
start?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. I really like the word tapestry better. I told Brian I wasn't going to repeat that phrase again. You know, most every business in America that's a national or international business deals with a lot of different jurisdictions for a lot of different, you know, either federal, state, or local requirements. We all do. You know, I have property in different places, and so I deal with lots of different regulations. And so, I guess that's kind of my response. That if you want to do, I think there are very appropriate times, and maybe Chairman Martin is about to set forth a federal policy on E-911, and I think we'll all cheer and be thrilled that someone has taken a stand and said this is the way it's going to be. I think there are very appropriate federal goals and policies, And, you know, we want to talk a lot about how the information highway is taking the place of our interstates. And, you know, so I think that there are some policies that may be much better to be set forth on the federal level. I also think that the states just have a historic and very important role in protecting the citizens that live within their borders. So it's almost like this four-pronged test. I mean, they're just places when, yes, there should be a federal policy. We absolutely agree. There's a collaboration going on right now in the insurance industry where Florida, I believe California, and Texas are coming together under a cooperative agreement. And actually, I'll tell you specifically about this because I've got it somewhere here. And what they are doing is so that because they have a huge percentage of the insurance industry, and so they are going to have every single thing uniformly done. And each of those three states is going to accept all of this. You know, maybe we start doing that. I know that for Tennessee, after the 271 process, Florida negotiated a performance measurement plan. That has just gone through, and all nine Bell South states adopted it. And so it was total uniformity. We've just gone through an update of that. Florida took the lead on that, although I actually opened a generic docket on it, and so have had some give and take with Bell South over the last few months. But from what I understand, Florida's now actually voted their commission, and they will be sending that around to the nine states. I would assume we'll all accept that. Another just very simplistic example is when there's a merger or an acquisition or whatever, and a company's changing names or whatever, both the FCC and all the states require that consumers are notified of that. You know, the FCC might say, you know, you only have to put the logos on the letter or something. Some states even get down to typeset. But when a company comes in and says, TRA, we have to send out these letters to five states or 50 states. Would you accept the letter that the FCC approved? I don't think that we have ever not done that. So I think whenever there's an opportunity, we're willing to do that. I think that's yet another way that you build flexibility in, you know, at different levels of government. I think it's very important for you to have those people in front of you and say, do you plan to raise rates? You know, that's part of my job. And so, yes, I think they should have to come before us. You know, if we can waive our rule about a notification letter and send out the same one, I am all for the efficiencies of government. So I hope that's responsible.
Other comments from the panel on what Cheryl called a patchwork and Debbie called a tapestry?
Please don't use that word. One last thing. Let me just say my disclaimer that I didn't say at the beginning. I'm so used to Anne-Marie Kovacs doing this. But I'm just representing myself as one commissioner. I am trying to represent NARUC, a group of commissions. I do not represent anyone else on the Tennessee Regulatory Authority. Thank you.
Other comments?
I'll comment on it. Yep. We've got to get rid of the patchwork. There are situations that I've heard of where a company wants to centralize customer service responses, telephone banks, And depending upon what state the person calls from, the operator has to push a different button to find out how they have to answer the question in that state because the requirements are slightly different between state A and state B. So the customer service representative really doesn't become an expert anywhere. Instead of becoming an expert in customer service, they become experts in figuring out how to comply. And then you get situations where this patchwork is not only a patchwork between states, which may be tolerable in some extent, but a patchwork between like providers. Give you two examples. If Time Warner Cable in Atlanta decides to offer a $20 a month telephone package and Bell South wants to meet it, it will take Bell South approximately 120 days to get approval to lower its rate. If SBC in Chicago wants to lower its rate for some sort of competitive reason by $3 a month, it will take a minimum of 45 days before it can put that through, which if only 35% of the people ultimately took this new package, $35 million in consumer value will have been lost due to regulatory interference in the marketplace. So I think that state regulation of the basic telephone service, as an example, makes good sense. The plain old black telephone that grandma needs. But when you get into enhanced services and this variety of different alternatives that the consumer can pick and choose upon, both the patchwork as well as regulatory lag damage the consumer. Yes, he may ultimately have choice, but not in a truly competitive marketplace.
If Bell South wants to lower their rates, I can assure you we'll make it happen more quickly than that.
Can you talk to Georgia then? Because the state law precludes.
Well, I just wanted to perhaps rather not the versus patchwork versus tapestry. I want to use the word federalism. We have many laboratories of democracy in this country. We have developed a country based on 50 states. We are not for uniformity in our regulations, our local values, our local mores. That is not how this country runs. Nobody in this country wants Washington to dictate everything that's going to happen around the country. They want local people who are responsive to local needs to be addressing those things. The example that Mr. Merlis mentioned to me was particularly apt, I thought, because somehow these large companies managed to comply with all sorts of different complex plans if you want to purchase your service. If they want to market to you specifically to offer you a special deal or a package, somehow their salespeople and their customer service people, you know, they're willing to impose those complicated burdens. And as anybody who's tried to figure out their plan with their customer and figure out if their plan is the cheapest plan for them, you know that these are complicated. And somehow their customer service reps are asked to comply. But when you talk about making sure that, say, a city or a town that has a large number of people who speak Spanish make sure that they are going to get the adequate information that they need, then it's off the table. That's too burdensome for Verizon, one of the biggest companies in the country, to take care of. So I don't find it credible. Second level, one of the things I did want to mention is that I think everybody agrees that to the extent that it can be administratively more simple, local government is absolutely happy to work on making sure that that's more simple. One of the things that we are doing is right now in an industry roundtable with telephone companies, cable companies, satellite companies, internet companies, everybody you can imagine, we're all working together to figure out a way to simplify and make more sense of the current telecommunications taxing regime. And that's very important. Local government takes that very, very seriously, and we are willing to sit down and talk about it. But I think we have to put in perspective the types of burdens that we're discussing. And I mean, I just have one more example, is that often businesses say, well, let's just get routine consumer protection rules. We don't need anything special for telecommunications. But we have different consumer protection rules in 50 states in this country. And they say that's what they want. But those are different around the country. So I think we have to look at that, some of those concerns, with a little bit of a skeptical eye.
I'm going to quibble perhaps a little bit with the question, or maybe not the question, because a lot of people do talk about patchwork of regulation, but I don't think that you can just answer the question based on gee, we would prefer everything at the federal level or prefer everything at the states. Going back to my earlier comments, I think you really have to drill down and look at the specific responsibilities in this case and look at why such regulations exist in the first place. I mentioned that we believe that an appropriate role for state commissions is carrier-to-carrier oversight. Along the same lines, something that they probably should not generally be involved in would be end-user price regulation. Perhaps, again, the basic service, something like that. I do think that there ought to be some ability for the commission to entertain complaints about anti-competitive acts or activity. Certainly, I'm not going to begrudge the incumbents some additional pricing flexibility, but you know, some states have such things as win-back rules, for example, and there's a reason. You know, there's sort of a balancing between when you have access to customer proprietary information and they're calling up to change their service. You don't want the customer service representative that very day or that on that very call, trying to sell them to stay rather than switch, because that's that in and of itself is anti-competitive. There are some rules about that today. You know, how closely they're followed, I don't know. But again, I think you need to look at the specific activities of each branch of government or what is the appropriate role. You know, as a general case, you would say at the state level, less economic regulation, but perhaps more of the whatever we would put into this competitive category of no anti-competitive acts, carrier-to-carrier oversight, those kinds of things where the competitive market is not going to take care of itself, particularly carrier-to-carrier, because there is not, I think we all know, a competitive market for sort of interconnection necessarily. Finally, let me just mention some of the state telecommunication dereg bills that are out there and distinguish between some of the bills that Quest, for example, has been pushing and those that SBC has been pushing. And Quest has managed to pass bills this year in Utah, Idaho, and Iowa. And SBC looks like they might pass one in Missouri, and we'll see in other states. But the big difference is that in every case in the Quest bills, there was a backstop, if you want to use that term, that said if things get out of hand, the commission can step back in. And they're all a little bit different in the way they're phrased, the way they're worded, and how they would operate. SBC's bills, though, would basically gut the commission's authority, say that you can't do anything, other than what the feds do. And that's a big difference, I think, in looking at when you do allow this additional flexibility or change the rules, is there a way to put the egg back together if necessary? And, SBC apparently doesn't, want the commissions to have that authority. Quest has been a little more reasonable to their credit and said, we can live with that because we don't think it's going to be a problem.
Can I just follow up on that one point? Tennessee, actually, I'm feeling much better about my state today. So thank you all for having me. But our legislature, as part of our original Telecom Act, built in a way for Bell South to deregulate services. And they had not taken advantage of that for years. I mean, when I came to the commission, I was kind of shocked that they hadn't filed. Since then, they have filed a couple of petitions to deregulate some business services. Our legislature also had this backstop provision where we could limit the services that were deregulated, some or all. We could put conditions on them, and they could have been geographic areas, based on market conditions. And then also allowed us to, we're going to have them come back in and show us some data in a year after deregulating some services. So I thought that was very visionary and forward-looking, even though it hadn't been taken advantage of until recently.
Thank you. Other questions, I think, over here. Would you identify yourself, please?
Good build-out of broadband. I think over 90% of American homes homes have access to broadband today. The problem is that not only 25% of homes subscribe to it, and that's where the United States is falling behind the rest of the world. So NTIA and President Bush have said that one of the big reasons why we're behind is because the prices aren't low enough. Broadband's too expensive here. It seems to me you could get prices lower either by regulating them or by promoting more competition. I think we'd prefer to see more competition, and my question is how, what suggestions do each of you have for members of Congress about how to take steps to promote more competition?
Let me repeat the question. John Windhausen, who is a consultant, pointed out that the issue is not the issue in the United States is not broadband deployment, but rather broadband subscription, which he attributes at least in some part to price. His question is, how can we drive the price down, presumably to increase subscription levels? And his theory is that competition would do that, and he's asking the panel to comment on how can competition in broadband be increased to drive price down and increase subscription levels.
I have a quick answer. The first quick answer is that we want more head-to-head facilities-based competition, and the way that we can do that is make sure that entrants who are coming into the market are fully deployed throughout the country, that every single home does have access so that they have a choice, so that if one company is too expensive, they can move to another company and they have a choice. And I think one way to do that is when local government is there to ensure you've got deployment in every single neighborhood to every single house and multiple. This problem does not go away just because there's one wire. There needs to be two, three, four, five.
Other comments on competition?
We have a broadband bill going through our state legislature right now, and one of the starting points of that bill was to even find out where is it, which goes to your point. Now, is that based on that census where if there's one person that has access in the zip code, then that zip code is counted, and that's how we got to the 90%, because 90% of Tennesseans don't have access unless you call from their home. Unless you call it because the schools are hooked up. So one of the starting points of both what our legislature wants us to do and what we want to do at the TRA is find out exactly what is going on in our state, because there hasn't been a comprehensive study. I actually think that NARUC did a study that Lila Jaber out of Florida worked on maybe several years ago, but it hasn't been updated through her joint 706 board. And I actually was appointed to that, and we haven't had a meeting, but I'm hoping Chairman Martin is going to follow up on that. More regulation is very unpopular. Having the government get involved in deployment is very unpopular, but the states that are all, the countries that are all above us, that's precisely what's happened. So don't have a answer, but am willing to be a cheerleader.
Other comments on the question of competition?
Just a couple of quick comments. Certainly we encourage and look forward to more facilities-based competition. I would argue that I think the 90% figure is probably correct in terms of number of the population that can be served. It may not be, in a rural state in Tennessee that 90% of the areas are served, but based on where people actually live, I think 90% probably have availability from home, because we alone in the cable industry have invested about $1,300 per subscriber, a total of about $95 billion since the 96 Act, and we have made cable modem service available to 85%+ of the homes in the country. So when you add DSL where we don't overlap, I think the 90% figure is probably pretty good. But in terms of your question, and by the way, I absolutely agree with your premise that there is too much of a fixation on where we stand in terms of broadband penetration as opposed to deployment, because I think there are a number of factors that explain penetration. Price may be one of them, but I don't think it's the biggest. One of them is when you look at the alternatives in those other countries, many of them had metered rather than flat rate local phone service. So dial-up was just about as expensive as broadband. So the broadband, broadband dial-up value relationship there may have been more compelling, where many people here are happy. Certainly narrowband numbers seem to be going down, but, you know, many people are perfectly happy with their narrowband. Also, we have a lot of people, this may be, you know, let's take Japan, for example. I presume that a lot of people there have broadband at work, but perhaps employers in Japan are a little bit less sanguine about their employees playing around on the internet during the middle of the day, and maybe U.S. employers are not so strict about that. But we have, you know, surveys have been done, focus groups, et cetera. There are a lot of folks that, I have broadband at work. Why do I need it at home, for example? There are still, you know, when you look at the PC population, the number of folks that have computers in the home, the broadband penetration statistics look a lot better. Because there's still 30-plus percent, I think, of the population that doesn't even have a PC. And in some cases, that might be affordability. In many cases, it may be they don't see the need. So, you know, I think there's content issues. There's this price-value broadband-narrowband relationship, a number of other reasons why we appear to lag in penetration. But I think in deployment, particularly given that it's, at least in the U.S., been almost entirely, not completely, but almost entirely, through private risk capital, I think we're in pretty good shape.
Other comments?
Just want to add, John, you're right. The number I had is 92% of the population has access to at least one broadband provider. 62% of the population has access to at least two broadband providers. And with the continued investment of private capital in wireless technologies and the like, you know, it'll get better, but there are a variety of factors. Competition's the most important thing insofar as, or most desirable, but there are a variety of factors. People don't have home computers. They can't afford the home computer. They have access at work. There's a lot of reasons for it. Our goal is to build it out, make it available, and hopefully get customers.
If there are no other comments on this question, I think we've come to our appointed hour. Let me ask all of us who have listened to the panel to thank our four panelists for an excellent conversation. Thank you all for coming, and we look forward to seeing you at the next Internet Caucus event. Thank you.